Could you start by saying your name and spelling it?
Sheila Whittaker, SHEILAWHITAKER.
And what's your date of birth?
21st of June 1963.
And we're looking at the area between Leighton and Leightonstone, which was on the route of the M11, the proposed M11, from 1984 to 1994. So could you start by just telling me when you moved to that area?
Yeah, I moved to Leightonstone early autumn 1985.
And could you sort of tell me like where you lived within that period?
Okay, all right. Well, I moved to 103 Dyers Hall Road in autumn 1985, which was a house shared by Mark Sowden and Joe Rodriguez. And I stayed there for 3 years. And then after that, I moved to 18 Claremont Road and stayed there for about a year. And that one was a London and Quadrant house. 103 Dyers Hall Road was an Acme house. And then after that, I moved away from the area briefly for about a year over to Homerton in Hackney to stay in another London and Quadrant house. But at that time, I was still involved over here in Leightonstone because I had a room that I rented as a studio from Peter Owen on Dyers Hall Road. And I was also back here socially a lot. So I was here about half the week for that time. And then I came back and moved in with Peter Owen in 101 Dyers Hall Road, which was another Acme house. And then I moved out of that house, probably after 3 years, maybe 2 years, I can't remember, moved out of that house up to another Acme house on Fillybrook Road, which was shared by Steve Rushton and Ruth Silverstone, and stayed there for about a year, and then moved to another Acme house with them on Grove Green Road, but on the opposite side from the houses that were demolished. It was a buffer house that was owned by the Department of Transport and let to Steve through Acme. Stayed there for probably about a year. And then I moved in with Peter Owen again in Grove Green Road into another Acme house, which was almost opposite the Northcote pub, but not quite. Sort of, if you're standing outside the Northcote pub facing the other side of the road, it was over to the left. Can't remember exactly which number it was. Maybe 135, actually.
So what year did you finally leave the area?
Me and Pete left that Acme house in 1997, and we moved. We stayed in Leightonstone, we're still here, we bought a property. Mm. So I've never left the area. The house on Grove Green Road, I think, continued to be let through Acme, or maybe we were paying the licence fee directly to the Department of Transport by the end, I can't remember, but we were there until 1997. It was sort of just before people were being given the option to buy their houses if they wanted to, but we moved probably about a year before that process happened.
Okay, so what would be really interesting in that order?
Yeah.
If you go through the houses, so you describe each house, what it was like.
Okay, all right. 103 Dyers Hall Road was a wreck when I first came along to it. I first visited there in August 85 when I came to visit Mark, who was just moving in there. And it was a wreck. The windows had all been broken. There was a tarpaulin. Well, floorboards had been removed upstairs, but then a tarpaulin put across the hole. And Mark and Joe thought that whoever had been using that house had left it there like that as a booby trap. They'd found old syringes there, so it had probably been used by drug addicts, bags with glue, that kind of thing. It had a beautiful garden, overgrown garden, because it was the end of a terrace, so it had a part to the side that was the garden as well. So it had a bigger garden than most of those houses. And it had really cold floors downstairs, because it was concrete floors downstairs. And I moved in, I first visited there in August, and then probably by October I'd moved in properly, I think. And it got very cold in the winter. We had no heating. At some point we installed a gas fires upstairs, but I know when it got cold that winter we didn't have any heating initially, and we went out one day, me and Mark got our £20 together or whatever it cost then, and went out and bought a Caligas heater, and we really needed it. Mark and Joe and me worked on decorating the house and making it nice. And then in subsequent years, more work was done to it. But it was very basic, really. The kitchen downstairs was just a little tiny, you know, there was the corridor in from the front door, and at the back of the corridor, the hallway, there was a little door, and then there was just the extension of the corridor, and that was the kitchen, really. It was one of those little kitchens that's sort of probably about 6 foot by 7 foot, and then the back door, and it was just enough room to have the fridge and the cooker on the right, and probably maybe we had a little table on the left, and you could just about squeeze through, you know. That was the kitchen. It was really basic. Mark and Joe had their studios downstairs. Joe's studio was the front room, and that was absolutely crammed full of all his sculptures that he'd brought from Nelp, from when he'd been at college, I think. He had some beautiful carvings in there, and then things constructed out of wood. And then Mark had the downstairs back room, and he worked there. And that felt more like a working studio space. He used to do plaster casting and all sorts of stuff in there. I think he used to work with fiberglass in there as well. Am I making that up? Clay, plaster. He cast things basically. And then Joe, the outside of that house, on the side, there was a lean-to that Joe set up, and he used to chip away and carve things out there outside. And I fairly early on, 1986, maybe halfway through 1986, or maybe spring 86, I found a room at 101 Dyers Hall Road, which was Peter Owen's house, and used that as a studio. So I rented that from him for £5 a week. And that was my studio upstairs back room in Pete's house, which I just painted out white. It was bright sort of lime green when I moved in and painted it out white. And that was my studio, which I used. And then, so I was there in 103 Dyers Hall Road for 3 years. Then I moved to 18 Claremont Road, and that was London and Quadrant House. And nobody had studios in that house. There was Rachel and Nick who lived there. Rachel was an artist. Nick was more involved in environmental sciences. I think he was driving buses for London Buses, but he became involved in ecology and environmental issues. And they'd had that house since they were students, I think, and they'd done the same kind of basic job on it that we'd done in 103 Dyers Hall Road, so painting it all out white, getting some furniture in there. They had a nicer kitchen, quite a nice proper little kitchen in there. It was the same sort of basic house, you know, two rooms upstairs, two rooms downstairs, little kitchen, little bathroom back tacked on the back. And then moved over to Homerton, and that was the same kind of house but a different sort of area in a way. Slightly different community over there. Well, I didn't get to know people there apart from our immediate neighbours. And it was probably a bit more mixed, culturally mixed. Over there, more black people. People used to sit out on the summer's evenings, people would sit out at their front of the houses more, you know, kids would play on the street more over there. I suppose it was more, you know, there were more families living there as well. Whereas over here, in the ACME community over here, well, a few people did have children, but it wasn't that sort of community at that time, I don't think. It was more people before they settled down and had children, I suppose. People using the houses as studios and, yeah, different sort of atmosphere, I think. And over here, even though I was living over there in Homerton for a year or a year and a half, possibly, I don't think it was any more than that, this still felt like my community because this was where I knew everybody and, you know, life was about being an artist and having your studio and knowing other people who are artists and being involved in projects around those sorts of things. And that was what my life was about, and this was where my sort of peer group was, if you like. And so then I moved back here, moved in with Pete to 111 Dyers Hall Road, and Pete had been living in that house since 1985, and he'd done surprisingly little to it, really. So the same old tatty orange curtains were still up in the windows that had always been there before he moved in, and I remember they were sort of gradually falling apart. They were something synthetic material, and probably when he moved in they looked quite decent, and then by the time he moved out there were big, you know, bits of them had just started falling away, basically. Actually, it's not quite fair because Pete had cleaned the house and he had painted the floors. I think he'd painted the floorboards in his living room red and the walls were painted white, and, you know, it wasn't that he'd done nothing, but it was the same sort of idea of, you know, you make the house good but you don't perfect it, because we all knew it was only temporary. And in fact, when I first moved in to Dyers Hall Road, our expectation was that we would be there for a year or possibly two at the maximum. And so it was like that all the way through. It was always a sense of we might be moved out in a year's time. So you just kind of made do. You did it. You made it decent enough to live in, but you didn't do a lot more than that. You'd make it nice in a sort of quick way, but you certainly wouldn't. Say if you had, what's that paper chip wallpaper on the walls? There was that stuff. Wood chip wallpaper on the walls. There was that stuff on the walls in Pete's house, I think, in the living room anyway. And so he'd just paint that over white. You certainly wouldn't spend a lot of time scraping it all off and filling bits with plaster necessarily. You'd sort of do, you know, cover it up, but wouldn't spend weeks and weeks perfecting the job, because it wouldn't be worth it, because you might only have 52 weeks there anyway. So it was that sort of thing, really. So lived there for a while and carried on having my studio in Pete's house, which I had a studio in Pete's house since 1986, upstairs back room. And then when I moved in there, yeah, the downstairs back room was the bedroom. And the upstairs front room was Pete's studio. And the upstairs back room was my studio. And the downstairs front room was the living room. We kept it like that for a while. And then I moved to... Where did I move to? Then I moved up to Philibrook Road to live in one of those beautiful big Philibrook Road houses, and was sharing with Steve Rushton and someone else called Ruth Silverstone. And I had the downstairs back room. And those Philibrook Road houses were much bigger than the Dyers Hall Road houses. And they were really beautiful houses, you know, with steps up to the front door and, you know, big, big, you know, higher ceilings, big hallway, more rooms. I had the downstairs back room as my room, painted it out, and I sort of inherited that room from another artist, Kath Baker, who used to live there, and she built this sort of, not quite like a four-poster bed, but she built this sort of enclosed bed space in the back corner of that room. So it was sort of a bed that had like she built this frame so that it was kind of like surrounded by curtains. So I loved that and just used that really. And I had French windows out onto the back garden, which was just gorgeous. And, you know, that house was in a similar state of repair to all the others, really. So I can't remember anything being dire in any of the houses.
So in the Philibrook Road house...
Yes.
You've mentioned this bed.
Yeah.
So did you both live in there and... It was your studio that 1 year.
No, that I'd moved out. Me and Pete had one of those gaps in our relationship. So I moved out. Well, an experimental gap in the relationship. You know, one of those times when you're trying to work out if you want to spend the rest of your lives together or not. So we didn't split up immediately. But I moved out to try and reassess things, I suppose. So it was just me that moved into that house. And also at that time, Pete was working. He had a part-time job in Hull School of Art. So he was away for, you know, a couple of nights a week. And so as well as it being time to reassess the relationship, it was also true that I didn't want to be living on my own I didn't want to be on my own somehow overnight. I think I felt slightly insecure. So it seemed like a good idea to move out for two reasons, really. So did that. But I mean, I would be popping back to Pete's house to feed our cats and things.
So.
And my studio was still in Dyers Hall Road, still in Pete's house. Still kept that room on as a studio for at least a while.
So Philibrook Road, that room is where you lived.
Yes.
And then Dyers Hall Road was your studio.
Yes, continuing. By then people were beginning to have to move out of their houses. You know, Department of Transport was taking possession of houses. So we had to move out of the Philibrook Road house. I think I was there for 11 months. I think it was just under a year.
Can you remember what year that was?
Well, that's quite difficult. I've got a feeling it was probably 92. I think Steve might remember better than me. Maybe 93. And then the three of us, me, Steve and Ruth, were offered a house on Grove Green Road. I think actually that house was one of the first houses to be repossessed and they wanted it because one of the first things, probably the second thing that they did in terms of getting ready to build the road was build a block that looked like an office block that spanned several of the back gardens in Philibrook Road. And I think that building is still up there actually, or maybe it's gone now. But anyway, they wanted to build this building. I don't know if it was their headquarters or whatever. Probably the first thing that the bit of construction I remember for the road was when I was still on Dyers Hall Road, when they widened the railway bridge that goes across Dyers Hall Road halfway up. That was probably the first thing I remember happening. Yeah, so moved from that house on Philibrook Road down to the house on Grove Green Road, which was the opposite side from most of the houses that were Acme houses, but it was still a house that was owned by the Department of Transport and let to us through Acme. And I think at that point, Ruth moved out quite soon after, and I took over the upstairs front room in that house as a studio. So I must have moved out of Pete's house, moved my studio out of there more completely. by that point. So I had a studio in the upstairs front room on Grove Green Road and worked away there for a while. So then, and then at around that time, Pete had to leave his house on Dyers Hall Road. And was offered another Acme house further down on Grove Green Road, almost opposite the Northcote pub. And he moved in there. And at that point, I moved back in with him. And I don't remember what number that house was. It might have been 135. And that house was a bit of a wreck as well. And anyway, we moved in and Pete did quite a lot of work on that house. And I think that was probably quite late. I mean, that probably was 94. It might even have been later. It might have been 95. And initially Pete, right, so that house had, we made it quite nice, but in the same sort of makeshift way, you know, doing a quick job on it. But Pete did do a lot of work on making the front door very strong. He actually made a new front door for that house and it was really strong. And I think that's true to say that he made it. He did a lot of work on the doorway anyway. And it was the inner door that he made. And that really did block out a lot of noise from traffic on Grove Green Road. And that house was the same sort of thing. Downstairs front room, downstairs back room, which was our sort of kitchen dining room, the room where we lived. And then upstairs there was, back room was the bedroom, which we painted a really nice blue colour. It was really nice. It's very cosy. And then the front room was the studio, which initially was Pete's studio. And then he took over a studio on through Acme. He got a studio at Carpenter's Road. So when he moved out of the studio there, it became my studio and he was working in Carpenter's Road. And I did an awful lot of work in that studio. That was a particularly productive period for me. I remember doing a lot of work there. And that was quite a good room for a studio because it was wide. It was the whole width of the front of the house, so it wasn't just a narrow room. It was quite a good size.
So could you just explain, like, what the state of that house was? What you did to it?
Right, well, Pete's the one that did most of the initial work, because at that point, I'd become diabetic. All this happened at the same time I became diabetic, really, so it must have been 96, actually. So we're outside the scope of the time that you're looking at, but it's still Acme houses. Or maybe it was 95. Sorry, I can't quite remember. No, I think it was 95. I mean, I did some decorating, but Pete did the heavier work because I was actually quite ill. The state of the house, well, it was cold. We installed, I remember there was probably a gas fire in the back downstairs room, but we installed a gas fire in the front. We got someone to install a gas fire in the downstairs front room. I remember that because we wanted to start using that room, and it was too cold initially. It was next door to a local, someone who you might describe as a local eccentric, this guy who was sort of, dealt in anything secondhand and probably didn't appear on any records anywhere, and lived in a house that, well, Pete got quite friendly with him. He lived in, you know, he squatted that house basically, but nobody knew who owned it, so nobody ever tried to get him out of that house. It was sort of a bit of an anomaly, I think. Mm-hmm. And he would knock on the door and ask Pete if he was interested in a chest of drawers that he'd picked up from somewhere, for instance. So we got a couple of bits of furniture from him. You know, he was just being neighbourly, basically. And, you know, we renovate. There was a chest of drawers that Pete renovated and did a nice job on, actually. Except that the drawers never ran, it slid in and out really smoothly. It was always a bit rickety and a bit of a push and pull to open and close the drawers. But it looked good. And it was things like that. And we'd pick up bits of furniture in secondhand shops. So we were quite enthusiastic about, you know, 50s and 60s stuff. So we'd pick up the odd table or a couple of chairs. Or Pete used to get stuff from Hackney Car Boot Sale, which was very big at that time. And he'd come back with nice things like an angle poise lamp, which he'd picked up for £1 and was absolutely covered in sort of, you know, dust and nicotine and tar and stuff, because it had obviously been in a very smoky office. And he cleaned it up and it was perfect. You know, there were things like that. You could always pick stuff up easily. So, and then there were things like, you know, you could pick up nicely shaped bathroom mirrors and stuff like that for not very much money. So we were there for I don't think we were there for long, actually, but we made it nice.
Because going back to Dyers Hall Road,
yeah,
I do remember that Pete spent a lot of time painting that floor, and it was in quite, even though it was quite basic.
Yes.
It became quite good condition.
Yes.
And I particularly remember the furniture, because he used to part collect bits and part make them.
Yes, yes, yes.
Could you talk about that furniture?
Yeah, there were things that he made. Like he might find something that had a nice set of legs on it. You know, the sort of things that either were or were reminiscent of those sort of Festival of Britain type legs of things that splay out at a certain angle. So anything that was like that, he would take. And it might be that, you know, there was a nice pair of legs on a table, but the top really wasn't any good. You know, that wasn't authentic or whatever. So he would separate the two things. He once made a really nice low coffee table and cut out a big oval shape from MDF. And attached this nice set of legs to that, and then painted the whole lot a really nice kind of, well, you call it teal, I suppose, that sort of greeny grey colour. And so we had things like that. And then there was another table that was a little bit higher that was the same colour and had the same sort of set of legs that we did the same thing to. Yeah, yeah, that sort of thing was really nice. And then things like coat racks, sort of little things that you screw to the wall to hang coats off, that sort of thing as well. Yeah, so getting your own, following that sort of enthusiasm through, I think.
So the coat racks and the table legs were 50s.
50s inspired, at least. I mean, maybe everything might not have been completely authentic. But that sort of thing, the kind of thing that you think of as, you know, Festival of Britain, post-war, that sort of new things that were new ideas then, or I think were, you know, that sort of new style that came in the 50s. That not, I know, I realise not everybody's houses in the 50s were full of that kind of thing at all. But from now, you know, from these days, we look back and think of that as being very 50s. That sort of stuff, and it went on into the early 60s as well, I think. And
and also thinking about the house where you lived with Mark Sowden,
yes,
and Joe Rodriguez,
yes.
You talked about their studios being downstairs. The floor was concrete.
Yeah, cold, freezing in winter.
But almost quite appropriate for a studio.
Yeah, good for doing heavy work.
Selected.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit about how that house was modified as a kind of, I suppose, loft space in a way?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting comparison. I think, as we got settled there, Well, the aim was to be living and working in the house, but obviously three adults in a small terraced house was quite crowded. So upstairs, the upstairs front room, which was the bigger room. Oh, yes, early on. Right. So upstairs, there were two rooms, a small, tiny bathroom, and then there was a little box room at the front. And very early on, Joe decided that the wall separating his room, which was the front bedroom, and the box room ought to come down. So I remember being there and helping knocking that through, and luckily it wasn't a supporting wall. And and I remember just Joe going at the wall with a sledgehammer one day and contributing to that, probably myself, but it was quite heavy work. And, you know, so cleared that, and he did a good job of it, you know, did a proper job of making that room into a nice, I mean, you couldn't, you know, he cleared all the rubble and probably plastered over the cracks or the big hole or whatever, and painted it a certain sort of grey blue. And so that was Joe's bedroom, but it was also our living room. He was very generous spirited in that way, and we were living quite communally, so when it wasn't night time, when it wasn't sleep time, that was where we would sit. So if, you know, Joe didn't even have to be in, you know, me and Mark would use that as our living room. So there was Joe's probably single bed over by the side, and then there was a big, again, homemade low table made out of chunky bits of wood, not that sort of 50s, 60s influence of design, but more sort of just chunky, you know, something made from bits of timber that had been found. I think it had black legs, I seem to remember. And, you know, then a couple of chairs. I mean, probably armchairs that we found either secondhand or out of a skip, maybe even, or maybe, I mean, I can't remember exactly, but you'd sometimes get chairs from, you know, if somebody's parents were getting rid of their armchairs and getting a new three-piece suite, then things like that would arrive, you know. We could get those over into our houses. That was another way that we got furniture as well. So that was quite a comfortable room, the upstairs front room, with lots of pictures and sculptures and things around. And the aesthetic in that house was probably a little bit more influenced by somewhere like Kettle's Yard in Cambridge. You know, is it Jim Ead? Yeah, Jim Ead, Kettle's Yard in Cambridge. Mark was very keen on that sort of aesthetic. So the upstairs of that house sort of felt more like, it had that kind of influence to it. So sculptures and maybe a couple of stones or, you know, that sort of thing set very ornamentally around. And then the back bedroom, which was mine and Mark's room, we stained the floor a certain sort of mahogany-ish colour. And Mark made a bed, you know, got the timber and put slats across and made a proper double bed base, and then it's obviously easy to buy a mattress from somewhere and decorated the room and made it homely, really. And one thing I remember is early on, because when we moved into that house, as I said, all the windows were shattered, and I think the window frames had probably gone as well. So Mark remembers making window frames as if, but he didn't know how technically you made a window frame. So he made the window frames as if he was making picture frames, because technically that was how he knew to make a frame. So that was what they did there. And then a little while later, sort of opened up the stairwell. And yeah, I remember painting the stairs, the wooden stairs. I remember painting them a sort of a primrose yellow, pale primrose yellow, because I think we definitely wanted to make a sort of a homely feel that was separate from the downstairs studios, which had a, you know, a sort of small scale industrial feel, really, and wasn't homely. So it was sort of, I remember that feeling quite important to paint those stairs that yellow colour, because it was a bit brighter and lighter. And also because that hallway was so freezing and chilled and dark. And then took the, I think maybe very late on, and this might have happened after I moved out of this house, actually, they opened up the stairwell and took the panels and the banisters out so that it was sort of open plan. And then could they, you know, there's a photograph showing where they'd put objects, sculptures and interesting lumps of wood and things like that along the side of the stairs. And then hanging a mirror and pictures and things. So, yeah, that house definitely developed its sort of own interior sort of aesthetic.
So when you say opened up the stairwell, can you explain more specifically what that was and why that happened?
Well, see, I don't think I was there when they did that. I think that happened after the... Three years later, I was there from 85 to 88, and I think they probably did that in, you know, after I'd gone. But what they did was took the banisters down and the panels that were there. There certainly wasn't original, you know, Edwardian Victorian spindles. It was, you know, flat panels that had probably been put in the 60s. And they took all that down and just opened the space up.
Was there a practical reason?
Oh, right, leading question here, Alison. There might have been. There might well have been. I don't know. You'd have to ask them.
The reason I've asked
you
tell me. Is to draw out from you what you said in the initial chat we had.
Yeah.
Which was that they took those spindles away so they could get big work up the stairs.
Yeah, so, see, Mark was there for that original chat, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't remember that.
That's probably what Mark said.
Yes. So did Mark and Joe take the spindles away?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it was they'd already gone by the time we moved in. Maybe I must be wrong. Yeah. I should think he remembers better than I do. Yeah, obviously they would want to move, have more
possibility. So that kind of brings the space much more into that kind of loft type.
Yes.
Where the living space kind of centres around the kind of idea of the sort of transformation of the domestic space into the industrial.
It gives more possibility to move things between the different levels of the house. Yeah. So they removed the spindles. People would shoot them for that now, wouldn't they?
And what type of work was you actually producing during the time that you lived in the area?
Right. Predominantly paintings. Paintings, drawing, collages, prints, photographs. Photographs that were photocopied and drawn on, collages that had photocopies and all sorts of stuff. Predominantly 2D, really, but yeah. And initially, when I first arrived, because I was fresh out of art school, and I suppose I was still influenced by the ideas at the particular art school that I went to, so I started off sort of working between genres of still life and landscape in quite what felt like quite a traditional sort of way, actually. And then went through a few different stages. Got to a point where, and I can't remember exactly what year it was, I think I stayed sort of still lifey and landscapey and for 2 or 3 years. And then I think I decided at some point it felt that I wanted to take on the environment that I was actually living in somehow, or ideas about it. And this probably, and at some point I got quite early on, I got involved in the initial stages of, well, probably it's not quite accurate to describe it as initial stages, but the campaign against the Link Road that was set up to fight the final public inquiry. So this is a lot earlier than Claremont Road type centred protests. So at that stage, and maybe a bit before that, I was working with maps and ideas of how the areas, how the landscapes represented in maps. and got quite interested in all of that sort of thing. Took a few photographs around the area, those sorts of things. And also, so that's when I started working more on paper and more graphically and doing more collages and printing, because you can build up layers. And so I was having this analogy between, you know, development in the area, the way landscapes are developed and interventions in the landscape and how unnatural it all is. And, you know, one layer on top of another in terms of urban development, along with using a lot of maps and imagery from maps, because that's how the whole thing was represented to us. You know, we knew that all, you know, we knew that we were going to have to move out of the houses to make way for this link road. And the way that was always explained to us was, you know, there's a diagram and it's a map. So you've got that sort of representation. So I started using those sorts of images. Spent some time taking photographs, painting tissue paper to make areas that looked like areas on maps. And at this point, actually, it was a map of Europe. It wasn't specifically roads at all. So, you know, political demarcations on maps, and sort of painting all these nice, pretty colours from maps and putting them onto windows, collaging it onto a window and then photographing so you get, you know, the light coming through, and then building up layers. And I took a lot. And actually, no, it wasn't all political. At the same time, it wasn't all that sort of, it wasn't just that sort of area. I did a lot of collages onto windows that showed, you know, ideas of urban development and layers and layers, but always starting off with, no, I don't think at any point I had any analogy going on for what was there originally. It wasn't just earth or land or woods. It was all in the realm of the urban development and some imagery that drew on political representations on maps and roads and housing and fields. I think at one stage did a piece of work that had fields in it, just, you know, green with white lines on it. A lot of that sort of stuff. Then what happened? Then then there was another stage of work, which was, I think from there I went into looking very closely at stones. Can't quite remember how that links, maybe it doesn't, but looking, well, it's sort of from, and doing a lot of work which was peering at things and under a magnifying glass, really, whether it was stones or shells or sometimes into the undergrowth in the back garden. And doing paintings and drawings that were trying to really describe texture, I think, texture and relief surface. Or objects that we'd had around in the house for a long time. So I remember doing some paintings that were of a sea sponge, and there were several paintings of the sea sponge, and that was to do with peering at the minute little holes on the sea sponge, and then doing paintings either that were of part of the sea sponge or the whole sea sponge as a still life object. So some of them were sort of making a landscape type image of a close-up, from looking at a close-up of a sea sponge, and others were sort of the sea sponge as an isolated object, as in a still life object. And then a lot of work that was using stones in the same sort of way. Sort of small worlds, I suppose, that interest in small worlds. So I suppose it developed that way.
And earlier you mentioned artiste. Can you tell me about that? How that all came about and at what time?
Okay, right. This was quite early on. So 1985, when I first came to the area to live with Mark and Joe, they had both been at North East London Poly, and Joe was the sculpture technician there. So he knew quite a lot of artists in the area, and a few doors down was someone called Simon Gough and his partner Caroline Smith. And so got to know them. And then Mark had been doing his postgraduate year up in Manchester with me, and another artist, Gary Doherty, had been up there at the same time. And he came down to London and moved into the area. Well, he was actually living in Plaistow, but he was up in Leytonstone a lot, and eventually moved into an Acme house up here. And so there was this sort of hub of people. And then through, then there was also Rachel Garfield, who had been involved, who had been at North East London Poly, and Vanda Harvey, who'd been at North East London Poly, and Matthew Parsons, who was at Central, but Central School of Art, but was Rachel's boyfriend at the time. And they were living here on Claremont Road. Well, Vanda wasn't, but she was around. And so there was this sort of hub of people, really. And Gary and Rachel probably were the most... They both had ideas about wanting to set up something. We all had ideas about wanting to do things. You know, we'd all started off at art school doing, you know, in the second year, third year, you sort of experiment with the idea of how you're going to carry on after you leave art college. And, you know, typically we would, you know, set up exhibitions or things. In Manchester, I remember being part of a student exhibition at the Hacienda that we sort of set up. And, you know, every one of us had done something like that at college. So then once we were actually out of college, we were all quite, you know, we were quite worldly in the sense that we knew that we weren't going to get into Cork Street galleries. Mm-hmm. So we knew we would have to do something for ourselves. And then I think with particular drive, I think Gary had particular drive to do something, and he had, and probably Rachel did as well. Gary had quite a strong entrepreneurial sort of streak in him. And when he was at college, he'd done quite a lot. He'd set up club nights and gigs in various venues in Hull, which is where he did his BA. And so he had this sort of try, and he sort of thought he knew about marketing, really. Well, we wouldn't have called it marketing then, but, you know, how to draw people in, how to create a buzz. And Rachel had a lot of experience. She'd done admin jobs part-time and stuff, and she felt she was quite an organiser and also with ideas. And so I think through one day, I remember being in the Northcote pub with probably most of the people that I've just mentioned, and Gary was floating the idea of doing something, you know, working cooperatively as a group of artists. Because he had also had the idea that it would be good to work cooperatively, because he'd seen there was a whole food cooperative in Manchester that he'd observed that had been running for 10 or 20 years successfully. And I think Rachel probably had ideas about the same sort of thing, that we could work cooperatively to support each other and to be, you know, stimulate each other, keep yourself feeling alive as an artist, as artists, but also be trying to promote our own work, you know. And so that idea was floated in the pub one evening, and we all went, yeah, that's a really good idea. And so it was sort of born out of that. And quite quickly we this is 1985, it's autumn 1985. We sort of went off in pairs, and we sort of identified various spaces that we might be able to do an exhibition in. And we each went off to investigate a particular space ourselves. We went off in pairs. Me and Mark went to something that we'd heard of called the Young Unknowns Gallery, which was on the Cut in Waterloo. And we'd got a portfolio of our slides together. So there's this portfolio which has the slides of about 8 or 10 different artists, you know, the members of the Art East Collective. In fact, I think originally we weren't called Art East Collective. I think originally Gary decided we were called Artists in Newham, which we weren't, because we were in Waltham Forest, but never mind, he lived in Newham. So, but quite quickly it changed to Art East Collective. So we'd take this little portfolio around and show it to people. And I remember going into this gallery in Waterloo and showing the gallerist, and he was a nice guy, and he looked at it and sort of said, oh, I like this one. But he thought that basically our work wasn't suitable for his gallery. I think he had... it was a small space and he had smaller work in there. And I remember him commenting on it being an interesting way to promote yourself as an artist, to do it collectively. Anyway, we didn't get a show from that, but I think it was Matthew Parsons who identified a space at the Conway Hall in Holborn, and we, in December and January 85, we did a group exhibition there, which we called Small Works, and was quite exciting, actually. We did that, and we worked together well as a group to put this small exhibition up on the walls, which probably had two or three pieces of work each, and we did the opening, and lots of people came along. We were quite well supported by friends and probably a few family members and ex-tutors, you know, people who knew people. And I sold one bit of work from that exhibition to an ex-tutor of mine, Fabian Peake, who taught me in Manchester. And that was great, so I had quite a buzz from that, and Matthew Parsons sold a piece of work to the same person as well from that exhibition. And so we felt quite confident, that was quite a buzz. And then after Christmas, sometime January, February time, Simon Gough and Gary Doherty were walking down Leytonstone High Road, and Gary still wanted to do something bigger and better somehow, and he, you know, really wanted to be at the centre of things somehow, I think. He had that sort of drive in him, and they were walking down Leytonstone High Road and saw this building by the railway bridge, which was number 528 Leytonstone High Road, which was a disused bathroom showroom, which had a to-let sign up on it. It's quite an unusual building. It had big plate glass windows on the ground floor and the first floor, and a big space on the ground floor. And, you know, Gary, you know, there was a yard that you could, there was sort of, he had the idea that there was space behind it and there might be even bigger possibilities behind the building. And anyway, they found out who owned it, and it was the construction company next door, Kind & Co., which had a managing director called Mr. Metchka. And Gary and at least one or two others, Simon probably, maybe Rachel or Vanda, went along to meet with Mr. Metchka and put forward the idea that we would like to run an exhibition in that space. And Gary sort of sold it to him as, you know, we'll put your building on the map, we'll draw people in, you know, we'll create a buzz, we'll make it look good. You'll be more likely to get a permanent tenant, you know, if you take us on temporarily. Someone else might be more interested in this building permanently. And so, and, you know, Mr. Metchka bought that idea and probably responded to, you know, that sort of youthful, entrepreneurial, DIY kind of spirit. And that was great. So, and it was, I suppose it was mid-80s, so there were quite a lot of, I mean, when I talked to the other artists who were involved about it recently, several people mentioned this point, that at that point in the 80s there were a lot of disused buildings around, and the idea of redevelopment and using spaces, it sort of felt important to get empty spaces used, and, you know, that was a good thing to do. So squatting, for instance, was more acceptable then. It was almost like you could justify it morally. And we weren't squatting this building, but it felt like it was a completely reasonable thing to ask to do. So we took this building on, and it was a really nice space in lots of ways. We did the same sort of DIY, rough and ready, make-do job of the interior that we do in the Acme houses. So it was stripping out anything that you could strip out, but not going as far as completely stripping the walls and replastering them. So it was get rid of all the rubbish on the floor and paint it grey and paint the walls white. But there was chipboard. Some of the walls at the back were chipboard. No, they weren't. They were pegboard, that board that has holes in it. So we certainly didn't remove the pegboard. We just painted it white and made a good job of it. The lighting was appalling. There were lights there, but they weren't the sort of lighting that you would ideally have for looking at artworks, but we certainly didn't have the money to do anything about that. And also, initially, we were only taking it on for a period of 2 weeks to do this one exhibition, so it was sort of make it as good as we can within the circumstances that we had. And I think we invested our own money in buying pots of paint and stuff, and I mean, I'm sure we didn't spend more than 100 quid or maybe even 50 quid. It was that sort of amount of money doing the space out, shared between sort of approximately 10 of us. Anyway, there's a booklet that actually itemises. There's the artiste document where we actually itemise what we spent, which we produce later. So we put this exhibition together, and it was a group exhibition, just, you know, a democratic sort of way of organising an exhibition where it was probably three pieces of work per artist. You know, nothing was decided, there were no ideas about themes or anything like that. It was more, you know, as Pete has said about projects he was involved in, it was more we exhibited together because we were a social group together. And that was sort of the reason for exhibiting together. And I think that was more the way it tended to be done in those days for a lot of people. Maybe not completely, but that was probably more common. And we put up this exhibition and organised a preview. Did our Vanda probably screen printed a poster down at North East London Poly print room, and we produced a preview card and sent it out to anyone and everybody. And oh, I remember going, it being in a second hand shop, and buying myself a dress for the occasion, you know, a sort of a blue satiny number with gold embroidery, and, you know, so got dressed up for the evening. And that was, and, you know, on the first evening, the opening evening, me and Mark came round the corner, well, over the high road, came from Dyers Hall Road over Little Footbridge, Norman Steps, and through the back streets. Then you come onto the high road, and we were almost opposite the gallery when we came onto the high road, and it really did look stunning because it was beautiful evening light, and the electric lights were on inside the gallery, and you could see inside because the windows were so big, and there was, in, you know, a lot of people there already, and it really did feel exciting. And that we'd done something really positive and fun and creative, and had a lot of fun at the opening, and then ended up in an Indian restaurant over the road later on, and lots of people there, and yeah, it was great. And then we kept the exhibition open for 2 weeks, invigilated it, sat on the exhibition every day, had a visitor's book, and I think we had over 200, somewhere between, maybe 250, maybe 214 actually. Quite a lot of visitors for a 2 week exhibition. You know, for an exhibition on Leytonstone High Road, we had a really good turnout of visitors. And we made ourselves known to local councillors and people like that. And all sorts of people dropped in during the day to see the exhibition. You know, it wasn't just family and friends. You know, there were local people who were interested. And then people that we didn't know but got to know, who were the sort of the other artists who lived in Acme houses in the area. A lot of people came over to see what was going on. And we got to know a lot of people that way. And we probably would have got to know a lot of people anyway, because people did tend to meet in the pub, in the Northcote pub, but that was how we got to know people at that stage.
And although you said you didn't really spend much in preparing the space...
Well, we worked hard at thoroughly preparing it and making it look as good as we possibly could, but it was on a shoestring budget, so it was sort of like stripping as much out as we could, but not being totally perfectionistic about it. I think the upstairs we did put in some sheets of plasterboard, you know, to cover over maybe a doorway and an alcove, something like that. So we did it well, but not in the way that you would do it if it was permanently, and not in the way you would do it if you had loads of money. But we did it as well as we could within the means that we had, which was like, you know, buying a few, some emulsion paint and a couple of sheets of plasterboard and things like that.
But you did quite a lot of extensive work, though, didn't you? You pulled up...
Oh, we pulled up the floor.
Some lino or
something. Oh, there were tiles, sort of. I think they were actually tiles, and there were flat bits of lino that were on the floors. See, it was I don't know how long the building had been empty, but it was a rough building. And the floor was hazardous, apart from anything else, it would be dangerous to have people in there because the floor, and I don't know if we were thinking health and safety in those days, we probably weren't, but it was obvious that the floor, had to come up because it was, really rough and jagged bits of lino and tiles and things. And it was quite easy to put, we pulled up what we could pull up easily and got and scraped some of the rubbery stuff that was in between the tiles and the floor off the floor and made it as good as we could. And then I think probably if there were a few tiles that were still solidly stuck down that we couldn't remove easily, we probably painted over that, cleaned it up as much as we could and then painted over what was left and made it as flat as we could. That sort of way of doing it. Mm. Painted it grey. Walls white, grey floor. So it was like our idea of a gallery.
But it was a really big space.
Yes,
and it did require a lot of hard graft.
Yes, yeah, it did.
I just wonder how long that took you and how many people were working on that side.
Well, I think we had 2 weeks. 2 weeks. I think we were in there for 2 weeks to get it ready before we opened the exhibition for 2 weeks. So it was probably, and I think we probably hung the exhibition over 2 or 3 days. So it was probably 10 days of graft to get the space ready. On and off, given our other commitments, because I think several of us were probably working part-time. Not everybody, some people were signing on or doing enterprise allowance scheme. Joe was the only one that worked full-time. He had a full-time job. But I sort of remember being there for a few days. I think I remember doing work upstairs, painting walls white upstairs. I sort of remember probably clearing some floors from tiles from downstairs. It's all a bit vague exactly who did what, but there are photographs showing Mark and Simon doing that sort of work and Matthew Parsons, and Rachel was definitely there doing that sort of work. And yeah, so probably over about 10 days that work was done, and then probably roughly 3 days to hang the exhibition, which happened fairly harmoniously, and everybody brought their work along and we hung it together. We all piled in and gave our opinions and swapped things around. We all had quite a good sense of discipline about how you go about trying to hang an exhibition in that way. So we, part of all of us had, part of our training was that you hung things up, stood back and looked at it, then changed it around, looked again, hung things in different places and tried it all out in many different ways before you made your final decision. And we all had that kind of discipline. That was part of the way we all approached hanging an exhibition. So there might have been a disagreement towards the end about something, but it was basically a harmonious process and we had a similar, we managed to hang, 3 works from each of 10 artists virtually quite well and quite harmoniously. And there were sculptures as well, big sculptures of Joe's and smaller sculptures of Mark's that were, well, there was one in the window of Joe's. There were two. Yeah, there was good. It was good space for sighting a few sculptures in the middle of the floor as well. We put a lot of thought into that process and I think we were quite good at that, in the time, in the context that we were working in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that was, did you say 1995?
That was March 86. So we took the gallery, probably Gary and Simon spotted that building. It was probably February, maybe late January. Yeah, January, February time. Then some negotiations. And then we got the space for 2 weeks. And then the exhibition opened. And the exhibition was on during March.
And then you showed other shows there. Yeah. Well, didn't you?
So we had such a high, such a buzz from doing that for ourselves that we wanted to extend it because it seemed like it would be useful. We thought that it would be, there were other artists who wanted to exhibit there. And also we thought it would be good, it was good from the point of view of getting to know people and creating a buzz and feeling alive and being an artist, doing something for yourself. And also, at least some of us were thinking, this area needs an art gallery. You know, we had that sort of mission to us. You know, we thought it was good to open up a gallery in Leytonstone. Why shouldn't Leytonstone have a gallery, especially when it had so many artists living there? So there were 10 exhibitions that ran there in total. No, actually, it was 11. 11 exhibitions in total between March and, I think I'm right in saying, September 1986. And so the first exhibition after hours was, I think, Andy Thompson and Duncan Newton, who were a couple of artists that some of us knew from art school because they were, you know, the kind of people who had part-time teaching jobs at art schools. And then other exhibitions happened, similar ones, you know, ex-tutors, people who were students at North East London Polytechnic, because that was the local art school, you know, it wasn't that far away, down in Plaistow, at Greengate House in Plaistow. Who else exhibited there? Oh, there was an exhibition that was organised by Pete Owen that was called Out East. Pete Owen and Sharon Hall organised that exhibition, and that was them putting on an exhibition of work by about 22 different artists who lived in the Acme houses in Leytonstone. So that was quite, that was a good one, because that was to do with the local community of artists. And they, you know, that idea came up and they said, they asked if they could do it. And we said, yes, great. Or we asked them to do it. I don't know which way round it came, but that exhibition happened as well. And then there was one exhibition which we put together from slides that people sent in to us, because that was a weird thing that started happening. We got a few packages of slides sent to us, you know, speculative exhibition applications from artists who'd seen the space. So we put together one exhibition from that, which included Mark Wingrave and can't remember the names of the other people, but it's recorded in the Art East booklet. And then another thing that I think is important to mention is the way the space was used, because in the Out East exhibition, which was the other Acme artists in the area, Cornelia Parker was included in that exhibition, and she was the only person who used the other spaces of the building, because as well as the downstairs space and the upstairs space, there was also a little attic space, and she went up into the attic. And it was, you know, all wood panelled stuff up there and interesting, odd, weird things, sort of like, I suppose, old wooden racks for putting mail in and things like that that were up there. And it was quite an unusual space. And she hung lots of, I think they're probably cast in lead or something, upside down Empire State Buildings up there. And that was quite interesting. I mean, it was, for me, with my very traditional art school background, I came from a place that was very, you know, painting, sculpture, printmaking, absolutely no installation or performance work went on in my background at all. So to see an installation being done in that space, for me, that was quite beautiful and used that quite kind of unusual space up there was really quite exciting for me as well, in terms of just seeing possibilities, I think. That was nice. And then the penultimate exhibition, I suppose the circle sort of widened. So the first, you know, there was our exhibition and then people that we knew quite well and then people that we were getting to know. And then it widened out a little bit more. So the final penultimate exhibition was artists that we didn't really know at all, that were just a friend of a friend of a friend. There was a contact with somebody. And unfortunately, that exhibition got burgled, and a lot of work of that was a big group exhibition, and a lot of work was stolen or damaged. And unfortunately, those artists decided they were going to sue us, and they didn't. Well, we weren't worth suing, so in the end, they didn't get anywhere with it. But that sort of put a damper on things. So when that burglary happened and they started letting us know that, you know, they were very unhappy about it, and they did mention suing us, I think Mark's got it recorded in a diary somewhere, I think we really felt a bit depressed and down. And also the other thing is that we were sort of facilitators of the space, and I think we'd sort of got a bit bored with just handing the keys, you know, taking rent money, giving it to Mr. Metzger and then handing the keys over. It had become a less creative activity for us. So at that point, we decided we'd do one more exhibition, which was a group exhibition for us. And the number of people in Art East at that by then had changed. It was down to about 8 people. But it was nice to do that final exhibition. And we probably learnt a few things from that, actually. Mm. You know.
And you mentioned rent. So was you paying the guy who owned it rent every time?
Yeah, it was something like £120 a week. So, I mean, we'd just take rent from the people who were exhibiting and hand it on to Mr. Metzger. We might have asked for £5 per exhibition towards our admin costs, you know, like phone calls and photocopying a contract, because we had a contract that maybe there was a tiny nominal amount, and maybe that £5 also helped against our initial costs for decorating the space, etc., doing it up. But basically it was, you know, money from the artists who are exhibiting and handing it on to Mr. Metzger. That's all detailed in the Art East booklet as well.
Okay.
Yeah, how that worked. Should we take a break?